Hey, this is Mark Patterson coming again live from Sun Valley, Idaho, and welcome to Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And this week, we had a super interesting dude. I met this guy on Denali at 14,200 feet. I had heard about the legend of Vern Tejas, and this is a guy that has summited Denali, which is a mother beast, 59 times. Imagine that. I mean, I had to come back and do that again this last year. I was fortunate to make it June 7th, 2018. I was there in May of 2017, and we had awful weather. And ironically, when I came off the mountain, I had some friends up there, and it snowed something like 9 feet. People stuck in a tent for 17 days, and it was awful. So I got very lucky. And to think that this guy has been through the trials and tribulations of climbing that mountain, he's created a life of purpose around mountain climbing all over the world. He's done the seven summits 10 times. Imagine that. He's got a book out called 70 Summits. He's jumped off a few of those, Elbrus, Kosciuszko, Aconcagua. He rode a mountain bike off Mount Aconcagua down in Argentina, which I've been up, and it's just insane to even think somebody would do that, let alone put a parasail on your back and jump off. So super interesting chat with Vern. It was great to get caught up post our successful summits on each end. And another note, we are, again, being sponsored by violetsareblue.com. This is about Cynthia Besteman overcoming her adversity and creating an all-natural skincare line. It works. It's awesome. So check her out. If you want to know anything that's going on with my climbs, I've got Vinson now set on my sights in 2/19 of January. That's what I'm looking at. So if you want to find out more about that, my public speaking, you can find out all those things at www.markpattisonnfl.com. And I've got a couple books that I'm coming out called Finding Your Summit. What else would they be? It's a playbook and a journal along with the e-learning course. So I'm fired up about that. So on that note, let's go talk to Vern. Here we go.
Hey, this is Mark Patterson back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And this week, I'm beaming from Sun Valley, Idaho. I'm back in this glorious little ski mountain town, and we are going across the country to somewhere in the Catskills of New York. We've got Vern Tejas. Vern, how you doing?
I'm very good. Mark, how are you?
Well, I'm doing fantastic. And you know, it's funny because when we talk about finding your summit, literally it is metaphorical because everybody's trying to kind of figure out their own way in life and where to go and what to do. But I literally met you about 2.5-3 weeks ago, on the summit of Denali at 14,000 feet. And, I'd heard about the legendary Vern coming all the way up the mountain. And then, it just, as our paths crossed, you happened to be at that camp when we arrived, and you came over and said hi, and I had a fantastic chat. So literally finding your summit, I literally found you on the summit on that particular day.
Yeah, that was wonderful to run into you guys up there. How'd your climb go? Did you make her?
Yeah, no. I was up there last year. We may have talked about this, I can't remember, but you know, I was up there early May. It was during a very cold stretch, and there was this lenticular cloud that just would not go away. We had encountered all kinds of snow. It just wasn't fun. You know, we ended up not making it, so I had to come back and do it again. This year, as you know, we pretty much followed you up and down the mountain. It was just glorious weather for that, you know, 2-3 week stretch of mostly sun. Yeah, we were able to get to the top the whole group. I was climbing with Victor, one of your co-climbing partners, and we got it done. So I'm lucky to be able to scratch that off my list. But you know, here's the thing that I want to get into. So for the audience, Vern is a world-renowned climber. We're going to get into this. I mean, your feats, Vern, are insane. I was doing all this research on you. I already heard about the legend, and really that only had to do with Denali. But, you know, all these other mountains all over the world and some of the things you've done, we're going to get into. But, you know, I was just thankful that I got my second time on Denali. I was successful, like I said, a couple of weeks ago, hit that summit, take the top, got back down safely. But you've been on top of that thing like 60 times, is that right?
Oh, just one shy of it. Yeah, 59 times. Who's keeping track? It's just something I love to do. I love that mountain.
Gosh, you know, this is something because, you know, I played in the NFL and I've been through training camps and I've been through tough challenges. And it's on that mountain, it is the most majestic mountain range, you know, all around you. And one of the things that just, you know, it's just hard to get through is I love climbing the part pretty much from 14,000 up to the top. That's where I felt like the mountaineering really kicked in. But, you know, squirrel, motorcycle, all those ridges that you got to come up, they're a bear with all that weight on your back. And to say you've done it that many times is just amazing. It's incredible.
Well, it's not quite the same kind of workout that you get in the NFL, but at the same, in the same breath, it is, very strenuous, as you now know. Once you get into a particular level of fitness, it's actually easier to stay there by continuing to climb than it is to stop and start. So for me, I've been training all my life for Denali, and it seems like it's been working out for me.
So how did you get into mountain climbing? As I'm reading your story, you know, you grew up in Portland, Oregon, and then ultimately you ended up going up to work on the Alaska pipeline and some Alaskan telecom. But what was that pull for you that got you into the mountains?
Well, even though I was born in Portland at a very early age, my family moved to Texas. So I grew up on the flattest part of Texas, the Gulf Coast, right outside of Houston. It's so flat there, Mark, they can actually raise sugarcane. That needs a lot of water. It has to be very flat. So I grew up without mountains, and because of that, I think I had this strong desire to test myself, to go someplace where you didn't just walk on a flat field. You actually had to expend some energy to get anywhere you're going. And so for me, mountains were calling, and I ended up going to Colorado at a very early age and found out that indeed was something I really enjoyed, being out in the great wilderness, testing myself, challenging myself in a natural environment. And so at a young age, I think I was 19, I hitchhiked all the way up to Alaska and fell in love with Denali the day I met her. Actually, the third day in the state, I was able to cast my eyes on the most beautiful sight in the world, and I've been going back ever since then. It took me 5 years to learn enough about mountaineering that I could climb it without getting killed. But once I actually succeeded in getting to the summit, I've been returning every year since.
I mean, that's just an incredible streak. So you kind of planted your stake, so to speak, in the mountain and became a mountain guide, and a mountain rescue, person that would go up and help others. But here's the one thing that I was blown away. You know, there's so many people that go up there, they struggle, and it's the hardest thing they've ever done. And, you know, you're kind of just walking up there. You've been up there so many different times with so many different people. And you're how old now? You're 60 what?
65.
Yeah, and you know, it's just like, I think this is a great lesson for a lot of people, that people who truly find their purpose in life and they're doing what they feel like they were meant to do, you know, it's just, you look like you're about, you know, 30 years old. You know, you're in fantastic shape and you're happy and you're not crammed behind a desk and you're truly doing, you know, something very purposeful. And I think it was really cool to engage with you and kind of see, and then you walked away and we're like, God, this guy is amazing. I mean, look how, you know, great he looks for 65, you know, comparing you to, I guess, the other people who just let their bodies deteriorate because they stopped moving.
Yeah, I think the big trick for me, Mark, was I got to follow my passion. And when you follow your passion, you're compelled on a different level. It's not work. It becomes a lifestyle. And for me, to be in the mountains is my happy place. And to be able to climb Denali now for so many years, and I started when I was 25. So you can see there's a 4 decades of climbing up there. It's something I'll keep doing as long as I can. It's just, for me, I was fortunate to be able to find an occupation that allowed me to be in the mountains, and particularly on Denali.
Well, obviously you've been recognized by a lot of your peers, a lot of the younger guys who, you know, for the most part, you know, kind of a younger man's sport, but you've been able to, thrive in that environment by keeping yourself in shape and your knowledge of the mountains and how to stay safe with your various clients. But in 2002, Sports Illustrated named you one of the top 50 Alaskan athletes of the 20th century, which is pretty cool.
It was quite an honor to be recognized at that level. I grew up with Sports Illustrated. My father was an Olympic swim coach, and to be honored by that particular magazine while he was still alive, definitely one of the highlights of my life. So he could actually see that I made the grade. He wanted me to be a swimmer, of course, but you know how life is and kids are. I decided to go in a different direction entirely, but to be honored as an athlete by Sports Illustrated definitely was a fantastic honor. There's no other way to look at it in my life. That one of the top athletes of the century was quite an honor.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't in that particular edition, of course, because I was playing football, but I was very fortunate to be graced somewhere in a variety of different articles, 5 different times in Sports Illustrated. And, you know, the thing about the magazine business is, you know, kind of going on the other end of the where magazines are going, which, because everything's going online, right? And so that business is not as thriving as it used to be, but I mean, that used to be the magazine, the journal that everybody would go to get their sports content. So it's really cool that they actually recognize you. I was climbing with another guy, a number of different expeditions, Mike Hamill, who you know, and I had never been in the Himalaya. You have, and we'll get into that in a minute. But in his opinion, he said that the Alaskan mountain range is much more scenic to him and majestic than the Himalaya. Do you see the same thing?
After climbing in both for many years, I am still very much in love with Alaska. The mountains there seem wilder, more remote, you know, bigger glaciation, really. Like the Helena Glacier that you and I both walked up a couple weeks ago, it's bigger than anything in the Himalayas. It's a huge glacier in itself, and it's just one of many. So it's a real, I guess, I'm grateful for the luck or the fortune or God's blessing to have been able to find a place that I really love. And then after traveling all over the world, I've been to every continent many times. I keep coming back and going, like, people always ask me, what's your favorite mountain? And I'm still in love with Denali. It's still my first love and my strongest love. It's just been wonderful to be able to climb it and share it with many, many other people.
Well, to put this in perspective for the listener, Denali Mountain Range National Park is 6 million acres, which is insane. It's the size of Massachusetts. So, and that's just the Denali National Park. So you're not even talking about, you know, Anchorage and some of the other towns up there. It's just remarkable the actual scope and size. So, let's get into some of these crazy things that you've done, you know, as you've gone around the world. The first thing, and this might be more than what I found, but at the time when this was published and what I read, you've done the 7 summits, which are the highest peaks on each continent. I'm trying to do 10 times. You've circled those at least 10 times. Is that right?
That's correct. Some of them many more times, like Denali, almost 60 times now. The highest mountain in Antarctica, known as Vinson, Massif. I've done that over 40 times, many times on the top of the highest point in South America, Aconcagua, over 30 times. Same thing for the highest mountain in Europe, Elbrus, where I'm going to guide just in 2 weeks. I'll be over there in Russia to guide that twice.
Yep.
I've done that over 40 times. So it's for me, it's part of my job, but it's also, it's my passion. So I'm very fortunate to have been able to climb everything at least 10 times, the highest point on each continent at least 10 times, but some of them many, many more times.
And how do you stack Everest compared to Denali?
Well, it's not exactly apples and to apples. It's, the altitude of Everest is definitely, something that is far and beyond anything we've run into on Denali. And because of that, it actually is more dangerous because you're actually climbing with very little oxygen. When you get to the top, you're working with 1/3 of the amount of oxygen that your body's normally used to working with. So you're actually dying from the high camp to the top. They call it the death zone for good reason. You're actually dying, but you're doing it in slow motion. So hopefully you get to the top and back down before it actually gets you. So for me, Everest is much more dangerous, but, I think Denali is way more work. There's no porters. The distances are greater. The weather's every bit as severe, and I think even more so, we don't get the kind of snow that on Everest that you get on Denali. It's way more work for Denali, and because of that, I feel that it's the best training ground for me before I go anywhere in the Himalayas is to have climbed Denali a dozen times before I ever went to the Himalayas. It's just a real step up. It was a skill level that meant that I could handle pretty much anything that was thrown at me by the Himalayas.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I really, that's why I was saying to you before, I didn't know what your answer was going to be, of course, right now, but I really felt as though that once we got at that 14,000 foot camp and everything kind of going up on the fixed line and then up to 17 and then, of course, from 17 to the summit, 20,000 plus, you know, to me, that was real mountaineering, and that was super fun to me. And, you know, luckily we had the right kind of weather. But on Everest, going back there for a moment, and I want to bounce back to Denali for a sec before going on to some of these other mountains. But on Everest, have you had, you know, situations where there's been a lot of adversity for the people that you've been guiding to the top of that mountain? Or have most of your summits, attempts, expeditions, have they gone according to plan?
Oh, there's always, you know, things that are unexpected that'll come up. People get sick, avalanches come down, crevasses open up and swallow the bridging ladder that you were on. Some of the biggest challenges is just when people get sick up high, it's really important to get them back to the lower levels where there's more oxygen, because everything is so dependent on oxygen as the basis of life for us, that getting people down, and that becomes quite an ordeal. Getting somebody through the icefall through the south side of Everest, which is where most people climb, has actually got a very dangerous section called the Khumbu Icefall, and to take somebody through there who's debilitated is very challenging. Even if they're ambulatory, if they're not all together with it in their head, if their consciousness level has been lowered, then they can be at risk every ladder, every time you cross the crevasse, and that becomes quite taxing and quite slow to get down safely. However, if the guy's non-ambulatory, if he's actually in a ladder and you've got to carry him, then you've got to get him and the litter carriers across the same ladders, across the same crevasses at the same time, and then it becomes an ordeal. So recently, they've been able to do much more with helicopters. Now, helicopters can fly that high, but some of the big challenges were in the past were getting people off the mountain down through the Khumbu Icefall.
Yeah, now, have you always guided with alpine ascent on most of these expeditions that you've been doing?
I've been with Alpine Ascent for 28 years now, so most of my climbing history of my four decades has been spent on almost three of those decades with Alpine Ascent. Great people, they hold a pretty high standard of being conservative and safe. And for me, that's the kind of people I want to work with, is the ones who value us getting back more than the summit. So that's always been high on my list.
Yeah, I know. I've been on a number of different expeditions with different companies, and I would have to say Alpine Ascent this last year. You know, I just got off again a couple weeks ago of Denali. Probably my best experience I've had in terms of the organization, the attention to detail, food, you know, a bunch of things that really matter, you know, at the end of the day that sometimes you just don't really think about until you're up there and you're in it. And for sure, I want to talk to you further about my Vinson and Everest, you know, expeditions coming up in the next year and a half. So yeah, so that's that. You know, I also, another guy here in Sun Valley that I'm friends with, I've climbed with, Ed Beesters. You know, as you know, he's done a number of expeditions all over the world with no oxygen. I had a chat with him on a podcast a while ago, and, you know, he was part of that whole 1996 in the thin air rescue when all those guys got into major problems up there. And, you know, unfortunately, they went up in the superstorm and he chose to go down, and it was just an intuition that he had that the weather wasn't quite right. And then when he actually summited after all those guys left the mountain, it was Bluebird Day. And, you know, it's just unfortunate that those guys decided to make a bad choice and climb in weather that they shouldn't have been in, and also go beyond the turnaround time and then running out of oxygen. And people ask me, like, Mark, are you scared of the mountains? And I hear about all these accidents, and for me, in my perspective, I'm interested in hearing what yours is that it's usually just bad luck. You know, an avalanche comes down like it did a couple years ago on Everest, which happens, you know, I mean, where it wipes out Camp 1, base camp, in once every blue moon, or it's just bad judgment, you know, people don't put themselves in the right position. It just seems like, you know, every single one of my expeditions, there's always a weak link who think they can be on a mountain. They don't prepare themselves in the right way, and they end up just wobbling to the top or getting sick or just not, shouldn't be on that mountain in the first place. But what is your experience in that? Do you agree with that, or do you just, I mean, what's your view of the world in terms of, you know, the danger that the mountains bring?
Well, yeah, mountains are risky. There's no denying that. There are different risks, though, as you mentioned. There's the ones that your decisions create, and there's the ones that the mountain conditions create. To me, to make bad decisions in that, be the risk, is something that good guiding is all about. We're trying to make decisions that lead to positive outcomes. I think, in the disaster of 96, there's ample evidence that many decisions were poorly made, and I think it's because of the competition that was going on between a couple of different companies. They made bad choices. Theoretically, there would have made great sense financially, but it was very poor things going on the mountain itself, which is where it really counted. That's lamentable, and that's something we can learn from, I think. It's still being studied in many of the schools today. I know a lot of business schools actually use that catastrophe, if you will, as studying leadership or lack thereof. So I think there's people learning from it in the business world, but there's every guy has taken home some bit of learning, some choice bit of wisdom from watching fellow guides die up there. And I mean, certainly some of the climbers did too, but the, you know, there's more guides actually died on that mountain at that time than the climbers. So it was very educational in a very sad, gruesome way. The other sources, or the other risks, such as the avalanche that came down and swept through base camp, I mean, no one could have ever predicted that. And that's one of the risks that you just have to say. Mountains are dangerous places. As the ocean can be a dangerous place, as the jungle can be a dangerous place, as a desert can be a dangerous place. We take the knowledge of the mountains and knowing that, you know, avalanches can happen, earthquakes can happen. That was an avalanche that was triggered by an earthquake. Those things, we just have to guess whether or not that's going to happen while we're in the mountains. And I don't think anybody could have predicted that. It did have devastating outcome, but, you know, when you die, knowing what the odds are, you decide to go there because you love the beauty, you love the challenge, and you're going to give it your best shot, and hopefully nothing goes wrong. I think that's a lot more admirable than making several bad choices in a row and perishing because of that. So for me, there's two different kinds of risk there. There's the subjective human risk of making poor decisions, and then there's just the risk of being in the mountains. You know, things come down. You know, all the mountains are going to be level one day. You just don't want to be there when they're in the leveling process.
Yeah, you know, you talked about mitigating risk, and I really agree with that. Not too long ago, I had Laird Hamilton, big wave surfer, on the pod, and, you know, he's got a crazy story with, you know, he really introduced taking jet skis and riding in to these gigantic waves. You know, I think he rode the first 100-foot wave in Tahiti. And the way he trains, and I've trained up at his house before with those guys, and, you know, we've got 35-pound weights in each hand jumping into a pool that sinks us to the bottom and then bouncing, you know, up and down and really working on that breath. And so much about mountain climbing is really breathing in and breathing out and trying to put more oxygen into your system so you reduce the risk of mountain sickness and those things. But, you know, even though he's, you know, in the water underneath, and guys like you are above the surface and high in the mountains, it's the same thing in terms of really understanding that there is danger out there, and then turning it around. And like you said, the objective and the subjective about putting yourself in the best position of success. One of the things that you and I talked about, but I read more detail, you became the first guy to do a winter ascent and summit on Denali. And so to walk me through this, like, why would you ever, I mean, Denali, like you said, I mean, I was up there in May of last year, and there's minus 60 degree weather, and that's like, you know, coming in the best season possible. And now you're going into a environment that is dark about, you know, 18 hours of the day, and, you know, brutal weather, brutal temperatures. And you were talking about strapping a ladder, you know, around your waist to mitigate if you fell into a crevasse. Obviously, you're the only guy out there. Explain how that all went down.
I'm glad you asked. Several people had tried to envision what would happen if you fell in a crevasse and you weren't tied to somebody else. All the outcomes are pretty negative. So some people had done some looking into, you know, can I tie myself to a pole vault pole, something very strong and rigid. Another guy, actually a Japanese fellow, Naomi Yamura, great Japanese climber, took very large bamboo poles with him. A friend of mine actually built a very complex contraption out of aircraft aluminum. This is all the understanding is if you fall in the crevasse, you want something to keep you from going all the way down to the bottom. So the idea was to have some kind of device to bridge across the top of the crevasse. So I must explain for our audience that typically in the wintertime, it snows and it blows. And when the snow blows across the top of a crevasse, eventually it seals over and becomes quite invisible. There's a bridge, goes the whole length of the crevasse, and the whole thing is covered. So it's a booby trap just waiting for you some poor fool to step on it and pop through into what we call the dark room. The idea with the ladder was to create something that not only would keep me from falling in, but would give me, allow me something that I then could crawl across to the side of the crevasse and then be on the side of it and hopefully live through the ordeal. Ladder, because I didn't have the money for a very sophisticated aluminum contraption. I didn't have access to bamboo, so I thought, you know, what is there that I can easily afford and is strong enough to hold my weight if I fall sideways on it? And that turned out to be an aluminum ladder, which I still have today, clean the gutters with it up in Alaska. But the idea was that if I were to drop through, it would span across the crevasse, and then I'd be able to crawl out on the rungs of the ladder in a horizontal position. Fortunately, I had very large skis that were also very strong. And the one crevasse that I actually did open the bridge, that I was totally skiing along, everything's white, everything's flat, and all of a sudden a black crack goes out from underneath my skis in both directions, 2 feet wide and 50 feet long. I would have gone to the bottom had it not been for my skis. I was able to then levitate off that thing very quickly. I had so much adrenaline when I saw that open up that I was able to actually jump with my ladder on, with my pack on, with the sled behind me, over the crevasse, and I survived without actually having either of it.
So the temperature up there in the winter, I can't even imagine. I know they've been as much as 100 below. There's a great book, 90 or 100 below. I can't remember the exact title. But for you, you'd climb, when I say day, it's really kind of night because it's so dark up there. But what did you do in terms of at night? Of course, when we were just up there, we'd pitch a tent on the surface, and that's what we would do. I can't imagine you were pitching a tent during that kind of crazy environment. So what would you do?
The big challenge, of course, is the cold. The dark is difficult to work with, but headlights are good for that. The challenge of camping in the cold is tremendous. It could be, as you were saying, 60, 80, 100 below. The name of that book actually was minus 148. That was the end of the wind chill chart for the wind and the temperature they had. They just quoted the wind chill chart, minus 148. It was written by one of my heroes, Art Davison. They experienced those kind of conditions on their summit attempt. I knew that that was a possibility, and I knew that for me, I could not endure those kind of temperatures. They had to dig a snow cave, and that's basically what I learned from that book was you need to get underground. It can be, let's just say, 60 below air temperature, but if you get underneath the snow surface, you dig yourself a snow trench or snow cave, you're then very, very much insulated from that 60 below weather, and you can actually get the interior of the snow shelter can be as much as 30 degrees above zero. You don't want to get any higher than that, of course, because then it starts melting. But 30 degrees above zero, as opposed to 60 below, that's 90 degree difference. And you can quite easily cook, repair your clothing, exercise, do all those things in the snow cave without actually having to endure the tremendous challenge of the temperature. Because snow, as you probably know, is very porous, and those little air pockets between the stellar dendrites of each snowflake actually acts as the air that was trapped in down. It's an insulation, and it's a very good insulator. And because of that, the temperature is hugely different than the outside.
Yeah, that's just insane. I mean, anybody listening could think that, you would even want to attempt in those types of conditions. Like, you're half insane. But that's also what drives you. And like you said, you've always had a great love of the great state of Alaska and that mountain range. Okay, so let's zip down to South America. I've also climbed Aconcagua one time, not 30. I think you said it was something like that. But
over.
Right? But over 30 times. But the thing that I was reading about that I was just like, holy smokes, is when you took a mountain bike to the top. I mean, I had my pack on and we're going forward, and I thought that whatever amount of pounds I was carrying at the top was impressive. Now I hear that you've got a mountain bike, you're pulling that thing to the top, and then you rode that thing all the way down. I mean, where did that come from?
Well, it's mixing two things that I love together. I love the mountain bike. It's really good for your legs, great for climbing. And then, of course, I love mountaineering. It just made sense to try to do something that no one else had done before, which was to ride my bike down the highest mountain in the Western Hemisphere. It's almost 23,000 feet tall, much higher than Denali. And some people think I'm a little bit crazy, and I guess that would be kind of proof of it. It was great fun. I loved doing it. I don't think I'll ever do it again. A lot of work getting the bicycle up there. and pretty dangerous on the way down, Mark. I wore a helmet, and I actually ended up using it twice when I actually went over the handlebars, you know, the upper steep section of the Camelotta.
Yeah.
I went over twice. I went over the handlebars and, you know, head first into the rocks below. I dust myself off, you know, check for broken bones. Not finding any, I got back on the bike and continued on down, but it could have been, less than wonderful, very easily.
Well, for sure. And, you know, look, I've climbed that thing and there was just a whole lot of rock. You know, it's not like a nice smooth trail that you're riding down. I mean, there's just big boulders and sharp rocks. And then as you get down a little bit further, I'm thinking under, like 18,000 feet, it's just like a big scree field coming down, right? On the other side. And it's just, you know, just for anybody, it's like every step you take, you know, you move a lot of rocks going down. It's almost like moonwalking going down the hill. I mean, it's just not sturdy surface at all. So I can't imagine what that would be like on a mountain bike.
It was actually kind of fun that I got the hang of it. I put my jacket, left it onto the back rack on the bike. I had a rear rack over my back wheel. And I used the jacket to pad myself, and I sat so far back that it enabled me to ride down that steep hill without flipping over and doing somersaults. And I actually put my sternum was on the seat itself, so I was way back. My weight was way over the back wheel. And I would run it out for a bit. Once I got to the street, after I got out of the boulders of the Camelotta, once I did the boulder field, I was on street, which is just small rocks and gravel. And then I could just hit the brake, my rear brake hard, drop one of my feet, my inside foot on a corner, and I could do a big fishtail turn and then head off in another direction. And that was really fun once I figured out how to bicycle down street. I did lots of fishtail turns all the way down the mountain.
That just sounds like a tremendous amount of work. So let's talk about another thing that you did. You might have been the first guy to do this as well, and that was to paraglide off Vincent Matip, which is in Antarctica, and Elbrus, which I've done in Russia. So again, where's this stuff coming from? I mean, are you reading a book? Is there somebody that inspired you? Or you just woke up one night and said, hey, I want to paraglide off one of the world's tallest mountains for Elbrus and certainly in Vincent in Antarctica? I mean, where did that come from?
Another mixing of my pleasures, my passions. I got into paragliding very early in the sport, back in the mid-80s. And the reason I got into it was the thing, like, it's so much damage on your knees coming down, especially with big packs on. I figured, like, if I could just slide down these mountains instead of walking down, it would be, you know, climax on top of other climax. You make the summit, and then you fly down. What could be more fun than that? So I've been very fortunate. I've been able to fly off the top of Denali, the top of Europe, Mount Elbrus, the top of Antarctica, and the top of Australia as well. I'm looking forward to mixing more of that. Now that I'm a little bit older, I'm starting to realize that, you know, my son's grown, and I don't have to worry about him not having a float. I'm thinking that I really want to get back out there and do things that are a little more crazy than I was for many years. There's about 20 years there. I've just kind of reeled it in, make sure that my son had a father. But now I'm thinking, like, you know, life's short. Might as well enjoy it. So I've got a new paraglider that's going to be here next week. And, it's built for high altitude. And I want to finish off climbing to the top with the paraglide, but then flying off all the 7 summits. I've done 4 right now, so I've got 3 more to do. And if I should succeed, look for a book coming out, authored by myself. It'll be called The 7 Plummets.
Love that. I love that. Well, listen, I still got Vincent and I got Everest on the radar, and they're coming up in the next year and a half. You know, off Everest, maybe I can do that one with you. I'll just jump on it. We'll do a double paraglide. I'll jump on your back and we can tandem down and, you know, probably back to Kathmandu having a beer, you know, like the next night.
That's
that's the way you have your cake and you eat it too. You have the cleanup of celery, the epitome of the climb, and then you get to celebrate immediately after because you're down in the tea house or in the tavern. You know, I mean, it's however, it is a little bit risky, and I'm starting to take lessons again, even though I used to teach it. I'm going back to get lessons just to make sure that my technique is impeccable so that I can do this with a certain amount of safety.
Well, I would be concerned, you know, you get to the top of Everest, and like you said, you come up from the south side, and that's coming through Nepal, and then you jump off Everest, and you're in the jet stream, and you end up in Italy or someplace, you know.
Yeah, yeah, so, you know, if you like the tandem routine, Mark, we'll make a case, and we'll send them off of Everest.
Yeah, I know. Let's talk further about that. I'm starting to like this idea. You know, most of the accidents that happen on the way down, so why not just jump off and fly? You know, you don't have to worry about Hillary Stepp and all those things. It'd be great.
There's no Kugel ice hole to go through.
No. Maybe we can do a zip line. One of the two. Hey, so listen, Vern, where can people find you?
Hello, I'm online, on the website called VernChaos.com. My book's out there, 70 Summits. You can get that on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it on Kindle. So that's out there. And I work it at Money Sense. If somebody wants to go on a particular climb, especially if you're into the 70 Summits, I'm available.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Well, listen, Vern, you know, it was a treat and a pleasure to meet you on the mountain at 14,000 feet on Denali. You know, again, I'm glad that we were able to connect, and I ask you if you'd do me the honor of being on the podcast, and said, of course, and you, stayed true to your word. And so I reached out to you, and then here we are. So, you know, you've got a fascinating life. You've got a life of purpose and passion. And something that everybody should aspire to, not necessarily be a mountain climber if that's not their passion, but to go after the things that they love. And I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story.
Well, thank you for having me, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, buddy. Take care. So, again, I appreciate it. Have a great day.
See you in the mountains.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, NFL.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.